good week. I'm going to try my best to get us finished up, certainly by Monday, of course, but I'm hoping by Friday, actually, that we'll have things kind of tied up, and then we can spend Monday going over your final and what to expect on the final. I also have all the papers done, so if you have not gotten one at the end of class, make sure you come and pick that up. Okay, today I want to just briefly... It's going to drive me crazy here, I'll just say this. I want briefly to talk about what's going on with the New Deal. So we've done this already, and there's not... If you've had a chance to read the Commonwealth Club address, you really have the essence of what's going to be happening in the New Deal. So I'll just make two points about this as we're thinking about the 1930s into the 1940s, and especially with the role of government and the role that it's playing in the lives of American people. So if you look at the opening few lines of the Commonwealth Club Address, this is usually regarded as the thesis statement that will go behind everything that Franklin Roosevelt does. He tells us right in the beginning of this statement that he believes, if you see on the second sentence there, this is page 718, "I want to speak not of parties, but of universal principles. They are not political except in the larger sense in which a great American once expressed a definition of politics, that nothing in all of human life is foreign to the science of politics." This is arguably one of the scariest sentences ever written by an American in the 20th century. Because what he's getting at here is that there's nothing that is out of the realm or out of the sphere of politics. He's allowing politics to trump all other spheres. So everything would become a part of it, yeah, whether it's religion or family, everything comes under that. And we know, and I hope you guys realized by this time in the semester, that the American experience was not based on that in the 18th or the 19th century. It was always based on a conflict and a communion of various communities, from time to time, from moment to moment, depending on what those overlapping communities are. But now we've seen in the 20th century that politics, and I use this term somewhat lightly but also properly, politics becomes totalitarian. There's no way around it. That whether we're talking about the Democrats or we're talking about the communists or the fascists, they all see politics as an all-encompassing thing. And think about how radically different that is from what we read with Calvin Coolidge. You know, one of Calvin Coolidge's most famous statements that he said at the end of his presidency was, "One of my greatest achievements was I left everybody the hell alone." And I think there's something profound in that. That is so fundamentally different from FDR. There is nothing in the world that FDR does not want to mess with. So anything he can tinker with, he will tinker with. And that's where we still are today. Yeah, amazingly, I don't know how many of you have been watching the news, but yeah, the proposal, the tax proposal, largest tax cut in history, which Trump proposed last night, is astounding. In many ways, it's a greater reversal, if it happens, it's a greater reversal of the New Deal than anything even Reagan dreamt of, if it happens. I'm skeptical, but the fact that you could even have a proposal like that is astounding. Not that Trump, when it comes to things like the border and other things, he is definitely a progressive. But on some issues, he seems to be quite anti-progressive. But I want you to keep that in mind, that there is a totalitarianism here. And this is exactly what de Tocqueville had predicted would go wrong. This is the soft despotism. It's not necessarily going to be the Nazi crushing your skull with his heel, but it's going to be more the big sister who's kind of coming in, maybe giving you free birth control or free milk or whatever it may be. So it's a happy tyranny, but it's still nonetheless a totalitarianism in that it sees politics as the totality of life. And that's what's really, really changing in the Great Depression, and the fact that Franklin Roosevelt is not only able to get away with this, but then is elected four times to U.S. presidency. It's just astounding. He's overturning every tradition, and the American people are letting him, obviously. You know, they elected him four times. Now, granted, his margin of victory decreases in every election, but still, he just wipes his opponents off the map. And he doesn't have really good opponents either. They're all kind of New Deal white people. None of them present any real alternative, except we could run a more efficient New Deal. But certainly, that will change all kinds of things. The second thing I want to note about this document is that when we look at FDR, you have to go back to his history professor at Harvard. You have to go back to Frederick Jackson Turner. Of course, FDR is a Harvard boy, and that means he knew all of these greats, including he would have been at school at the same time as T.S. Eliot. So he is at school with all of these people, Eliot as a student, these other guys as professors, and Frederick Jackson Turner had a huge effect on Roosevelt. In fact, his whole worldview is shaped by Turner. So when Turner says that the frontier is over and that America is over, that is the entire basis of the New Deal. The New Deal is not what we would call socialist. If anything, it's more fascistic than it is socialistic or communistic. But what it is, the basis of it, is deeply rooted in the belief that America is done. And the only thing a government is good for is managing the few resources that remain. So we can't take, I mean, it would be, if we look at someone like Mussolini, or we look at Hitler, or even Lenin or Stalin, all these totalitarians, their totalitarianism is always about creating a grand future. FDR has none of that. There's no grand future in FDR. The best we can do for FDR is to break even in the long run. So I don't want you to get the image that simply because FDR is often lumped in with progressives, that he has that sense of we're going to make a bright future. FDR's never making a bright future. He's an Eeyore figure. Everything is wrong. Everything is bad. The only thing we can really do is make the horrible acceptable. So that's where his, if we want to call it progressivism, that's where he's very different than the others. So, and that is also interesting that Americans kind of buy into that. So we'll talk about this briefly today, but if you get to someone then like a John F. Kennedy in 1961, who's just as terrible a person as FDR is. I mean, FDR is a horrible person in terms of his morality. JFK is just as bad in every way. But their politics are absolutely the opposite of one another. Now, even though they're both Democrats, FDR, the world is horrible. The best we can do is accept this horrible world. JFK is, no. The world is whatever we make it. We can have a gleaming paradise on the moon. We can do anything we want. So notice even JFK, he plays off. FDR says the frontier's over. JFK says, no, we're in a new frontier. And that is a critical difference. So even though they're both Democrats, they represent opposite sides of the Democratic Party. And FDR is an odd figure, but so is JFK when we look at the history of things. But I don't want you to look at it linearly as if, oh, there's FDR and then Truman and then Kennedy and then LBJ and the Democrats just get really bad. Like, no, they go up and down like everybody does. And I certainly would rather have a JFK in the White House than an FDR, but that's not saying a lot. It's like saying, you know, oh, here's a building in Topeka. Look how tall it is. That's a kind of faint praise. So, Alex.
Which legacy do you think has permeated the current progressive movement, FDR's or JFK's? I mean, at least personally, I feel like there's a lot of people, I mean, especially with the whole Obama's apology tour and then people still putting a large emphasis on the fact that we, you know, had slavery in the past, I feel like.
Yeah, we're in a weird moment, obviously. And it's a lot weirder than it was 10 years ago or 20 years ago. Much, much weirder than 20 years ago. So this idea of our kind of soul searching and browbeating, and we're in a weird space right now. And I'm not sure we can, I mean, maybe, I don't know if I could, Alex, maybe one of the political scientists or one of the 20th century historians could give you a better answer to this. Maybe Dr. Marino could. But it's hard to judge because we're in such a populist moment, which... It's rare in American history when populism arises. I mean, it's always there. There's always an undercurrent. But when it becomes dominant, it really has only happened 3 times in our history. And so for me, at least, it's hard to judge. I can't find anything in Trump that gives me any kind of, or gives me the ability to see any kind of stability there. It's so reactive in so many ways. And so... I'm glad it's not ideological, but it's almost so non-ideological that it's kind of insane, too, because there's no coherence to it. I think it's just personality, and so it's hard to judge. But that personality is clearly, that anger is so strong right now on the left and the right. You know, people aren't even talking to each other. And we've gone 25 years now of our politics being a joyride in the sense that whether we're watching CNN or MSNBC or Fox, it's all who can yell the loudest and who can make the easiest cutting point. And you just can't sustain a society based on that. You just can't. Of course, it shouldn't surprise any of us that everything looks like a game show right now, and that you can't tell the difference between Fox Sports and Fox News. It's all the same special effects. It's all the same loudness. So we're in a weird space. We'll get out of it. We always do. But it is a weird space, you know, unless God gives us a reprieve and kills us all. Anyway, we'll get out of it. We really, these things come and go. So, okay, good. Anything else on that? Sorry, that wasn't a great answer for Alex. It was a long answer, but not a great answer. So, okay, well, then I want to get into what you guys are going to be writing for your paper. And I want to talk a little bit more about the new left and the new right and how those things arise in the 1950s. And I brought a couple of things in, and we're actually going to listen to some music here in a little bit. We just want to talk about some of the cultural changes. But there are two things that radically, fundamentally alter the culture. Three things will radically, fundamentally alter our culture. Number one, not surprisingly at all, is television. Television really is not, it's not mainstream until the late 1950s. So in 1949, there would have been some television, but maybe one out of 20 Americans would have had one, and there was very little on TV. In fact, my mom just hates TV. She does to this day. But one of the reasons she hates it so much is because when she was a little girl, all they played was like 12 hours of wrestling matches in the beginning because they had nothing else to play. It was either the test pattern or wrestling matches. And, you know, of course, then you start getting this culture that starts developing. So you get things like TV Guide, which is a whole new way of reading. Now, you're basically reading stories about TV, or you're getting what is happening on TV, what characters and actors are. Actors had never meant much in America. You know, the last time an actor had been famous, he was famous because he killed the president. So actors are strange. It's Hollywood, and there was a lot of kind of anti-religious feeling towards movies because the movies were so dominated by both Jews and Catholics. So it was kind of a weird thing, and American Protestants weren't too sure what to do with this. But then you get things like Leave It to Beaver and all of these shows, The Honeymooners, these things that are really family-friendly. And so the whole culture changes, where you find people actually now, rather than sitting around the fire at night where they tell stories or the mom or dad reads, they watch TV. And it's a fundamental change in our entire culture that people can start just living almost alternative lives through Hollywood. And so the whole celebrity culture comes out of this. Whole new way of eating, things like TV dinners, TV trays. And very importantly, I mean, this is not a minor thing. This is radically reshaping our culture. What matters, of course, is, you know, the joke becomes, once you have TV, well, he's got a great face for radio. And that's a wonderful joke, because you could be the weirdest looking person, male or female, and be a great radio personality if you've got the right voice. But if you don't look quite right on TV, you're not going to make it. And you know, you imagine, just think about most of our candidates for the presidency since FDR. Yeah, there's some not so good looking ones, like Richard Nixon. But I want you guys to keep this in mind. He was regarded in the 1950s as one of the best looking men in the world. I think in part we look at him now because he's so tainted with corruption, so we see an ugly figure. But if you can remove that, he was certainly seen as very good looking in the 1950s. Really dashing. I can't explain that. You know, that's like, I know people think Jennifer Lawrence is, I don't get her, and I don't think she's any good. But there are these people that we just kind of go and rally around, and they become something that's important for us. And that's all a major change here. So the culture is going to change dramatically. And we're going to start losing a sense of reading. We're going to lose a sense of storytelling other than a five-act drama where everything tends to be resolved within 22 minutes or 30 minutes or 50 minutes. That it fundamentally changes our character. And I don't mean to suggest it's all evil. I just want to say it's a change. It's a radical change. The other thing that happens, and I'll come back to this in just a moment, is the introduction of rock music, which is, in so many ways, a return. And I'd be a total hypocrite to argue that I'm not into this. I have been as far back as I can remember. In fact, I remember listening to Yes all the way back when I was 3. These were important things to me. But rock music is, at its base, a return to primitivism. It is an attempt to go back to a 4-4 beat and have this driving bass and have the driving guitar and the driving, maybe, keyboards. Everything is just a primitivism. And yet, it is, and I realize we're different age, I've never made it through the entirety of a rap song. It just drives me crazy when I hear the stuff, which I can't even do. And I love jazz, but rap, and I'm sorry, this will probably offend people here too. I hate country. I just don't get it. It's like, why are you? So anyway, my point is, there's a real primitivism that comes back into American culture with this, and yet there's something deeply moving about that primitivism. So I can't help but think of my mom, and I'm going to play you guys a song here in a moment. The very first rock song, so innocent. Rock Around the Clock, very first rock song ever made. It was played during a movie called Blackboard Jungle, and nobody had heard rock music before until this producer put it in the movie. And my mom, this incredible figure, she and my dad went to this movie in 1955. It was one of their first dates. And they just stood up. They didn't even know what to do. The music was so moving to them that during the movie, they stood up and started dancing in the theater. And they weren't alone in doing this. This was happening all across the country, where teenagers were so moved by this that it caught on. And then, of course, Elvis comes out and so forth. And you have this huge movement. And rock becomes not just a return to primitivism, but it also becomes this way of expressing emotion and anger in ways that the youth had not been able to do. Now, of course, you can be a 70-year-old rocker. That's not weird. But you can imagine a 70-year-old rocker in 1955. That would have been really freaky. So it becomes a major part of society. And we'll see here. I'm going to play just some bits of music in a moment. But we'll see. I'm going to play songs from 1955 all the way up to 1972. And we'll see what changes dramatically over that time period. And then the third thing, and I'm sure this is not going to surprise any of you, is the pill. Now, this is a really interesting thing, because the birth control pill obviously allows for a woman, and I don't mean to be sexist here, but men don't take birth control pills. It allows for a woman, in many ways, and I'll just be as blunt as possible, to mechanize her body. That is, she can dominate nature with the pill. And here's where we have to be very careful. A lot of times in history, the argument is the pill liberated women, as if they'd never had a choice before. We know absolutely that from the very first moments of recorded history, women very clearly knew how not to get pregnant. They also knew how to abort if they needed to. It wasn't safe, but they knew how to do it. So the idea that suddenly, oh, we've got this pill and now everybody can be on birth control, that's outrageous. There had been birth control all the way back since the very beginning of humanity. So it may make it easier, and it may make it a little bit more efficient, though from what I understand, I've got 7 kids, my wife and I didn't plan a thing. She got pregnant on our honeymoon night, 9 months to the day of our wedding, our first boy arrived. Yeah, I didn't know what was going on. I still don't know what happened. But so I'm not necessarily the one to talk, but it seems pretty clear to me from what I've read that there are means, very healthy means, of having a regulation on that that don't involve chemicals. There are things that you can do, and it's not always perfect, but certainly it's there. But the pill's not perfect either. It's only about 96% accurate. So that 4%, that's a roulette wheel. That's pretty amazing, no matter what. But I just want you to keep that in mind. What it does, of course, then, is it does, whether it liberates women or not, I think some people might argue it does the opposite, but the pill certainly changes the way people perceive themselves
and perceive themselves within society. That is clear, absolutely clear. But it is a very, it's a dangerous thing, no matter how good it might be. We know long-term studies, the pill can cause cancer. It can be very dangerous, and to be on it for too long means that your body can be out of whack for the rest of your life. And but that's true for anything, any kind of medicine, whether you're on Ambien all the time or Paxil or whatever. This is just medicine. It's obviously an attempt to dominate nature, and it's always a little bit iffy. But I want you to keep those things in mind. So we don't have to talk anymore about it, but I want you to understand these changes, all in the 1950s and 1960s, do fundamentally alter our way of thinking about ourselves in the world. And it is, as you can see, these things are all kind of, except for rock, though that's based on amplifiers, there is something interesting about the kind of mechanization of the mind and the mechanization of the body. And Dave Whalen and I went to lunch yesterday, had a great time, but we were just thinking about how horrible. You know, my grandmother was an amazing cook, and my mom, as much as I love her, just... And partly because it was always hamburger helper and tuna helper and frozen fish sticks. And that was all part of the time. It was though science can improve every part of your life, including your hamburger. Now, I'm perfectly fine with a hamburger as is, but this was all part of the movement at the time. No breastfeeding, for example, in the 60s and 70s. Doctors actually gave women pills so that they wouldn't produce milk. It's really wild, all this movement. And I don't mean to sound like a hippie. I'm not, despite the hair right now. But it really is. You've got, it's just a strange movement in history. And we kind of moved past it. Now we have, of course, a reaction where everything's natural and everything's organic. But having grown up when everything was not organic and everything was boxed, it was pretty gross. So now just, you know, keep that in mind. I'm glad you guys didn't have to grow up with any of that. So, but it was all a part of kind of the mechanization of the person. So in the 1950s, you have a very strong reaction to all of this. And it's hard to call it left or right. So what we find among the best critics of the 1950s, so on the left, probably the most important critic is a sociologist named C. Wright Mills, fascinating guy. And on the right, though he would never once in his life did he call himself on the right, but would be Russell Kirk. These are the two figures of the 1950s that really made a splash in terms of trying to explain what's going on in the culture. They both rejected all three of the things that we see listed up there, and for the same reasons. The reasons were, this is a means, and the cultural changes that are going on, these are means of making us less human and humane rather than more human or humane. So if you've had a chance, I hope you guys have at least had a chance to look at it. If you haven't yet, you'll need to by Monday. Read that piece on the nature of tradition or the problem of tradition that Kirk has, that we have in the reader. But I also hope you've had a chance to read Dwight D. Eisenhower's farewell address, because Eisenhower, in his farewell address, talks about one of the most important things in terms of this fight over what is humanity and what is not. Eisenhower takes from both of these men an idea that we are developing what is called the military-industrial complex in society. And what this means is that we are now giving so many contracts to something like McDonnell Douglas or Boeing for military goods that we are fundamentally altering the course of American history, because now, rather than having, say, a natural business cycle in New York, we're pumping so much money into Boeing in Seattle that Seattle starts growing, and it wouldn't have unless government money had been going to that place. So you're changing the whole direction of American demographics by having so much funding. But just for those of you from Seattle, imagine if government just suddenly cut off all funding for Boeing. Your city would collapse. You know, you would still have Microsoft, and you'd have your coffee shop, but you know, it would collapse really quickly. And the same thing is true for those of you from Arizona. If they shut down McDonnell Douglas, if we just suddenly stopped funding the F-16, there would be so many jobs gone.
And that's exactly what Eisenhower is warning against. He's saying, look, we need to have a strong defense, but
we don't want a defense so strong that we're pumping so much money into certain parts of the country that we're fundamentally altering the very character of the American people. And he says, not only that, but what's going to happen to our universities? If we have a military-industrial complex, well, and just think about this right now. Any of you going to grad school, if you're going into physics, where's your money going to come from? You'll be totally fine. If you're good, all your money will come from the Department of Energy. And that's every college, and not this one, but every graduate school in this country in engineering and physics. If we didn't have a Department of Energy, they'd just fail. That's what they live on. And how many of you, if you want to go get your degree in, let's say you want to go to St. John's in Annapolis and get your PhD in great books, how much funding are you going to get from the government? Zero. And that, now again, we can be pro or con government subsidies for education. I assume we're all here because we don't believe in it. But having said that, it is a radical change when you think that from 1957, from Sputnik until today, that's older than I am. That's 10 years older than I am. So for 59 years at this point, we have been funding almost nothing but scientific endeavors in our universities at a public level. That's incredible to think about how that changes things. And that all changes Sputnik, everything. Don't get me wrong, science is fantastic. But it's not the only thing in life. And how many liberal arts colleges are even existing anymore? It was the norm 100 years ago, bless you. Now we've got about 6 serious ones. Because you just can't make it if you're a liberal arts school, because you need the money for your science to be able to do this. So this is what Eisenhower is worried about, this change of what he calls the military-industrial complex, in which the military is calling the shots for what we study and what we produce and where we move. So Eisenhower, you can't accuse him of being anti-military. This is the guy who beat the Nazis. He's not anti-military at all. But he recognizes that there have to be very, very serious limits on this. So I'm not going to talk much about C. Wright Mills. He's really fascinating if you guys are ever looking at the 50s and what the 50s are about, what they stand for. He is one of, in my mind, he's one of the 2 or 3 greatest intellectuals of the 1950s. There are a lot of people, however. People like Leo Strauss, people like Ray Bradbury. There are a whole number of figures who arise in the 1950s. It's an incredible decade when you think about things that are happening both in literature as well as in science, in government, in thought, philosophy. And partly, it's great for us because everybody who got beat up by the communists and the Nazis who survived, they all moved to America. So we had, there was a brain drain of the whole world. We got the best and the most hated people because they were going to be killed in their own land. So they moved to America and they taught at places like Hillsdale or the University of Chicago or Notre Dame or Berkeley. And you know, what a truly a blessing for America. I'm sorry if those people had to go through what they did, but just incredible that we had all of these fine minds. Most of our great thinkers were immigrants. People who, whether it was rocket science or philosophy, most of them came because they had to escape tyranny at home. But one of my favorite figures, and this is, we spend some time on him in this class, if for no other reason, we wouldn't have this class without him. Russell Kirk founded the American Heritage and the Western Heritage courses here. Our whole reader that you guys have for Western Heritage and American Heritage, he didn't write it, but it's all based on his own writings. And Kirk taught here for a very long time. If you guys ever have a chance, when you're checking out books, if you look at one of the bronze plaques right there by the checkout desk, you'll see a bronze of Russell Kirk's statement on academic freedom, which is, I think, the finest statement on academic freedom written since the Middle Ages. And it's our statement because our college adopted it in 1978. But I'll just tell you briefly about this guy. I wish we had more time to talk about him. But what's important about Russell Kirk is that he comes out of absolute poverty in Plymouth, Michigan. Plymouth's now a pretty nice town, but it was a very impoverished town. It was, he grew up on the right side of the tracks. They never had money. In fact, he remembers one time when he was a kid that his mother opened up, I can't
can't even remember, it was a Kipling novel maybe, and they found a $5 bill in it, and they were so happy because that meant that they could feed themselves for the next week. Now, so this is not someone who was born with a silver spoon in his mouth. And yet, he's a genius as a young man, and he begins to write as much as possible. And one of the books that he writes, two of the books that I mentioned here, one is The Foundation of All Modern Conservative Thought, is a book called The Conservative Mind. It's his dissertation that he publishes in 1953. And then you have a chapter from the sequel to that book, which was called Program, and it was a mocking title. It was called Program for Conservatives. And in both of these, Kirk wrestles with fundamental questions, bless you, Shiloh. He wrestles with fundamental questions about the nature of power, the nature of community, the nature of economy, the nature of tradition, the chapter you have. And what he finds in his own thinking is that he's trying very hard to go against the kind of predetermined determinism that's going on in the universities. His argument is essentially that, and it's nothing profound, and yet it is, because when he says it, that free will matters. That's, if you want to understand conservatism as it was developed, it comes down to free will matters. And so Kirk argues in a very forceful way that every person is unique, every person is good and bad, every person has, in the realm of justice, a role or roles to play in this world. And what we want to do then is not in any way conform to one another, but we leaven one another. Our job is not to wear the same clothes or to listen to the same music. Our job is to challenge one another at all times. Our job is really excellence. That's all we do. We pursue excellence. And it doesn't matter if it's excellence in taking notes or excellence in giving a lecture or excellence in talking to a friend. You just always do your best at these things. And that just sounds like kind of old folk wisdom. And that's really all Kirk's doing. He's just trying to remind us of the classics. He's trying to remind us of the liberal arts. He wants us to speak to Aristotle, and he wants us to listen to Aristotle. This is all he's doing, and yet it's revolutionary in the 1950s because people really hadn't done this. And what he does in The Conservative Mind then is he takes 29 people, everybody from Edmund Burke to Abraham Lincoln all the way up to T.S. Eliot, and he says, don't look for coherence. Why would you expect T.S. Eliot to sound like Lincoln? These are two different people. We want Lincoln to be Lincoln. We want Eliot to be Eliot. And so conservatism, from its very beginning, was never, ever rooted in an ideology. It was never rooted in anything but a sense of timeless principles. And really the only things we know that Kirk says we can know for certain, natural law, natural rights, and the dignity of the human person. Those are the only things we know absolutely for certain. And that's Kirk's point in all conservatism, that there's no program, his title is mocking the idea of a program, and that instead we just have to figure out what is best in this world. We're not always going to do that. In fact, we're going to fail all the time. Kirk recognizes that. He's no utopian. In fact, quite the opposite. But he does also recognize that there's this greatness. So I'm not going to read much, but I want to read to you just two passages from the second book, that is the book A Program for Conservatives, which was his response. So when The Conservative Mind came out in 53, every single publication in the English-speaking world that mattered at all reviewed it. London Times reviewed it twice. Times Literary Supplement three times. It was a major moment. Kirk was this young bachelor who hardly anybody knew except for his close friends. He remembers very clearly it was about August 4th of 1953. He walked into a bed and breakfast in Scotland, out in the middle of nowhere. And when he signed his name, Russell Kirk, the innkeeper said, "Oh, are you the famous Russell Kirk who wrote The Conservative Mind?" And he was so astounded. But he had just been on the cover of Time magazine, the July 4th issue of 1953, and he was a
it was worldwide success, and everybody knew who he was. He was a really, really strange character. Always carried a revolver, no matter where he went. He would walk around. He was a science fiction writer as well, and he was awarded the Count Dracula, which would have been pre-Hugo, pre-Nebula, and so he was given a Count Dracula cape, and he wore this everywhere. He just thought it was so funny that he had this huge cape. He used to wear it in Hillsdale. He would walk downtown to Broad Street. He'd walk from the college down. And he also carried with him always, he had this huge wizard staff. And you could pull a sword out of it. And so he always had a hat, his what was called a capote, a Dracula cape, and his huge stick sword. And he actually used it a couple of times because he was threatened. In places like Milan and elsewhere. This is pre-TSA, right? you can get away with this stuff prior to the TSA. But anyway, just an amazing figure and truly a romantic. In fact, he made millions of dollars. His book, The Conservative Mind, sold 1 million copies. His first horror novel, Old House of Fear, sold 1 million copies. He died poor because he believed that you cannot ever die with any money. You have to give it all away. He gave everything away during his lifetime. Just an incredible figure. Very, very interesting. But this is what he says. So all of these people are criticizing the conservative mind, saying, you've given us this idea of conservative, but you didn't tell us how many tanks we need to beat the Soviets, or how much we should pay for school lunch programs, or what our educational policy would be. And Kirk's response is, mocking them, okay, I'll write a program if that's what you want. And here's my program. Here's what I say. I say that if you're a real man, you will venerate the ashes of your fathers and the temples of your gods. I say that if you're a real man, you will strike out with terror and all the strength that is in you if your gods or your fathers have been told that they are wrong. Our time is sick, nigh unto death. It is a death by utilitarianism and literalness and liberalism. And therefore, my program is this. I want myth and I want parable, because myth and parable are those things by which we live. And here, I will give you one last thing. And by the way, I don't know if any of you are in sororities, but this was given in 1954 to the National Chi Omega Convention, where Kirk gave a speech on the meaning of love. He said, so I will tell you one secret. If you want to know what my program is, here it is. Before taking arms against a sea of troubles, there is only one question that ever really matters. What is the meaning of human life? The conservative never believes that the end or aim of life is competition. He does not believe it is success or enjoyment or longevity or power or owning lots of stuff. He believes instead that there is only one object to every human life, and that is to love one another. He knows that the just and ordered society is that in which love governs, so far as love can ever reign in this world of sin, and he knows that the anarchical or the tyrannical society is that in which love has become corrupt. He has learnt that love is the source of all existence, and even hell itself only exists because one being loved. He understands that death, when we have finished the part that is assigned to us, is the reward of love. And he apprehends the truth that the greatest happiness ever granted to a man is the privilege of knowing that he is loved and that he is loved at the hour of his death. He has no intention ever of converting our world into an efficient machine for efficient machine operators. He does not believe that it should be dominated by master mechanics. He knows that every single man is put into the world to struggle, to suffer, and contend against the evil that is in his neighbor and in himself, and to recognize triumph comes only through love. He recognizes that men are put into this world to live like men and die like men. He seeks to preserve a society which allows a man to attain manhood and not to keep him in the bonds of perpetual childhood. He is like Dante. He looks upward from this place of sin and slime, this world of gorgons and witches, towards the light which gives love to this poor earth and all the stars. And he knows with Plato one thing, that a man who will never love what he ought to love will never hate what he ought to hate. Right? That's incredible. And that, I mean, how many young Republicans pick that up and say, oh, I'm going to learn from Russell Kirk what conservatism is. And he says, be like Dante. That's pretty incredible. Think like Plato. Right? That's what matters most. And that's Kirk. And yet that's the foundation of all of this. So a really important, I think, look at things. Okay, here's what we're going to end with today. I know you're wacky, Professor. But here, and I'm not going to play a lot, but I'm going to give you a quick evolution of rock, because it really is a way of understanding our loss of innocence through the 1960s. And when we come back on Friday, we'll talk briefly about the 1960s, but of course I'm hoping you guys have all read those two documents, the Sharon Statement and the Port Huron Statement, and you've already got a good grasp of what's happening here. So this is the very first rock song ever written, ever performed. Just a few seconds of it.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock,
you guys at least know this.
10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, rock, we're going to rock. Around.
So simple. There is nothing complex about this song. Probably any one of you who's never played before could pick this up pretty quickly. But it's got some life and some energy. A few years later, still a lot of innocence, and yet existential angst. Two Jewish boys from New York. Pretty amazing. A little less innocent. This is an English band, The Birds. It's a song called 8 Miles High, which is about dropping acid, LSD. Notice the complexity? That's an amazing guitar and bass interplay. Okay. Another song about LSD. I know people like the Beatles. That's creepy. It's really, you listen to his voice. Okay, but now I'm going to take us back to America, where things are exact same time, but a little more innocent. Actually, a lot more innocent. You guys probably know, this is the Beach Boys. It's Brian Wilson. He actually was born in my hometown before moving to California. But that's gorgeous. That's, in every way, that's a beautiful song. Okay, Canada. It's considered the first protest song in rock history. It's interesting, if you've ever listened to the lyrics, it's about protests, but it's not clear at all that the protests are good or bad. All right, little Bob Dylan mixed with a very amazing young black man from Seattle, Jimi Hendrix. I couldn't play this. Probably the greatest guitarist who will ever live. All right, back to Canada. A little bit more innocent again. Notice, it's really interesting to compare what's going on in Britain to the U.S. Okay, Alabama. Georgia, sorry. Another drug song. Dreams, taking mushrooms. This is the Allman Brothers. All right, only two more. Go back to England, 1969. What is it, Katerina?
Led Zeppelin, the Immigrant Song. But again, I mean, just listen. Think about that compared to Rock Around the Clock. All right, final song. Britain. Anybody recognize this? Even the band name is crazy. Black Sabbath. This is called War Pigs. That's an anti-Vietnam song. All right, that's it, guys. I'll see you on Friday. What's that?
Papers.
Oh, yeah. Yep. Hey, and look, we still have time. It's great.